Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So, first off, I am recording the lecture today, just in case you know that. So I'm going to try putting these up online, because I realize I need to remember what I said to you guys, and I figure, so also help for some of you, I mean, if this lecture turns into a ghost town, I might reconsider my recording of lectures, but I'm guessing that I could do with some screencasting, which I was considering, but the trouble is if I do a screencast, then you're just going to see me here with an iPad doing this and talking, and then really you shouldn't be here. It gets really annoying because I can't use this. So anyway, that's happening, just so you know that. The other thing is that there is a quiz on CU Learn, if you have not noticed. You need to submit your answers by 11:59 tomorrow night. I'm going to give you the answers in lecture today. So, assuming you remind me, I will try to answer them. But if you look at the, if you look at here, we are at lecture three. You'll notice here the questions. It's one to think about. So now you should. Now one thing you should keep in mind with these questions is they are simple questions to kind of check in that you're getting things, but they are by no means all the content I am covering in the lectures. There is a lot more here than these questions imply, but they kind of give you a bit of a pointillist idea of the kind of things I'm going to talk about. The big thing I want to talk about today is what are the challenges in developing web apps? What makes web apps different from desktop applications? And as part of that, I will be talking about a history of the web stack in more detail than I talked about in the first lecture. The reason why I thought of doing this today is because I realized some of you all were proposing ideas for web applications that I was going like, are you really going to try doing that as a web app? Not to say it couldn't be done, but there are some things that are straightforward to do as a web app and other things that are very difficult. I won't say impossible because nothing's impossible. It's just some things are a lot harder to do than others. So be aware, especially given the constraints, that you're supposed to use standard web technologies. And I will elaborate what that means in this lecture. But just to realize, you should not be relying on any plugins. No Flash, no Java applets. Shouldn't be relying on any weird things on the server. You shouldn't be using PHP or anything. You're using Node.js. But we'll talk a bit in detail more about what that is. So one thing I want to do before, kind of give you some context, is so one thing is the web browser that's right now installed on this machine is a really old version of Firefox. So I don't have quite the extensions I wanted to running here. But I can show you some stuff. So first off, what is this at the top?
HTTP requests.
So these are HTTP requests.
You notice what they have at the beginning? What do they all say? GET. So, first thing you have to know in this class is what's the difference between HTTP and HTML? What's the difference?
One is a transmission protocol and the other one is a markup language?
Exactly. One is a transmission protocol, one is a markup language. But HTTP is what is used to get pages. HTML is what pages are rendered in by default. Now, you can use HTTP to transfer anything. It does not have to be transfer HTML. Similarly, you can transfer HTML files, HTML documents, using a variety of protocols.
USB stick.
A USB stick. Yes.
Carrier pigeon.
Yeah, carrier pigeon. So there's all kinds of ways you can get HTML to a place. So to give you a bit more context on how these two fit together, I want to go back in time about 20 years. So the web really took off in the 90s, well, really kind of got
got known to the public in 94 or so. 93, I think. Tim Berners-Lee, when did he make
it? Journal September
93. 93, yeah. So, 93, I think, is when Tim Berners-Lee made his first web browser. It's either 92 or 93.
I know the term Eternal September. The term Eternal September.
Okay.
Is 93.
Okay. So that's the.
That's like when there's constantly new users, so there's more new users than experienced.
Oh, okay. Okay, that is a little older than that. But anyway, so I can look it up on Wikipedia to find out exactly what I'm talking about. But the first web browser was created by Tim Berners-Lee. He's the one who created HTML, HTTP. He's the one who's been knighted and, you know, father of the web and stuff. But the thing you have to understand with the web is that it wasn't the only game in town. That wasn't the only thing that was available back then. What came before the web?
That God created light, and then it was the next day, right?
Yep.
Gopher.
So let's. I'm going to list for you some of the competing ones.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm not going to. Is this board though?
So, if you go back to about 92 or so. And before that, there were other protocols, other ways of getting information over the internet. Remember, the internet is a way of connecting computers together so they can talk to each other. I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by the internet in a second, because I realize a lot of you don't even know that, which I find a little disturbing. But anyway, we'll go there in a second. But back in 92, the technology, so Gopher.
NNT.
Yep, yeah.
Email, yeah.
Okay, we'll do, so that Usenet gets its own category. There's email, or which you have things like POP, IMAP was not there. SMTP. Yep, so file transfer.
Well, Telnet obviously would be.
So there's FTP. RCP. This is a remote login. Telnet.
IRC.
Telnet and RSH. chat. So synchronous chat as opposed to asynchronous email. You have IRC. You also have talk. Anyone ever use the talk command?
It's kind of rude on a Unix box. If you start talking to someone, well, you can write to their console and just send them a message that they can't ignore. And then you can talk. You get these little requests saying, so-and-so wants to talk to you.
Does anyone know how you found out information about a user? What the command was? Finger.
I love finger.
Okay, info. Finger. What a name for a command. Anyway. So, like, if you wanted to find out, is the user logged in at this time? You want to find out what their plan is? Because, you know, it's mostly grad students on the internet, and so you can see what are they doing. So you get their plan file and tell you what it is and tell them, find out what shell they have and what their phone number is and stuff. You can find that all out through the finger command. So this is kind of the things that people were using the internet for. Usenet NNTP. So Usenet is basically, well, news groups. That's what we're talking about there. The architecture of news groups is actually kind of interesting because it has a very decentralized thing, which has interesting scalability properties. But anyway, the key thing to know about all this stuff is it's fundamentally text-oriented. I'm not saying there was no porn on the internet.
We know you
because there was, of course.
There was internet.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But the fact is that what I'm saying is multimedia formats did exist, but the fact is the bandwidth and the storage required for it was so high that in general people didn't, you know, people stuck to text. Yes. and text. But
sorry, what did you write beside you?
NNTP. That's the Net News Transfer Protocol, I think, is what it stands for.
Network news.
So net news. So, but these are all text oriented. Now, the notion of hypertext, this notion of being able to follow links between documents. Does anyone know who's considered the originator of that? No. It goes back further than Apple.
Sorry,
HyperCard. You're thinking of HyperCard.
Yeah.
HyperCard, certainly, with their HyperCard stacks that run on one machine and stuff. That HyperCard was cool. If you haven't looked up HyperCard, it's got a pretty thing. But it was always on single machine. And the idea of hypertext goes way further than that. Further. You know? So, the one... I believe the earliest one is von Neumann. His pronunciation is completely different from the spelling, but von Neumann, he had an idea of a memex, I think it was. I think that's what he called it. I'll have to... If someone wants to fact check me, feel free. But he was thinking of a information database, things connected together. That was in the 40s. He was thinking about this, and then there's another guy who most people don't remember von Neumann for this. Especially his description was rather pretty. I think it was Yeah, he's kind of one of the inventors of the computer. Yeah, he was the guy responsible for getting built the original, like, some of the very earliest, you know, modern architecture computers. You should read some of the histories. He had a very interesting role in this. Turing's Cathedral is an interesting book about what von Neumann did, along with other people. But moving forward, there's this guy named Ted Nelson. Oh, I sure hope I got it right there. Otherwise, I'm going to be very disappointed in myself there. Ted Nelson, yes. So, philosopher and pioneer, he coined the term hypertext and published them in 1965. He's also credited first being the word translocution, virtuality, intersingularity, and teledildonics.
Teledildonics being a good one.
Yes. But the key thing is that the project that he had for hypertext is Project Xanadu. The goal of creating a computer network with a simple user interface, the document, sorry, with computer lib dream machines. 1960. This guy was trying to build something that we would call the World Wide Web. A bit ahead of his time. Just a little bit. But the thing to remember, whenever you start saying, oh, look, this person did this first, well, there's other people who thought of it first. Oftentimes, they're in the right place at the right time. And so the idea of hypertext, of interlinking documents across a computer network, had been floating around the heads of geeks for quite a while. People knew they wanted to do this, but how to do it was the question. Ted Nelson was trying to build the system. He was trying to come, originally Autodesk, of all places, was funding him to create some of the stuff for a while. And there was a long quest, software management nightmare. I mean, it never really worked, never really took off. But other systems came about that took his ideas, things like HyperCard on a single machine. On the internet, people were thinking about this and how to do it. So there was one of the ones is Gopher. Another one's Waze. So these were standards for interconnecting, you know, protocols and document forms for interconnecting documents. And they worked okay. I surfed around a little bit on Gopher back in the day. You know, you could get some stuff there. Also, the big way you used to get things on the internet was FTP. But anonymous FTP. There's still some anonymous FTP. The idea is that normally FTP, file transfer protocol, you had to log in with a username and password. But a lot of sites had set up an anonymous account. And when you logged in as anonymous, then you were supposed to, by courtesy, give your email address as the password. But it's not like it checked it. It was more just for those people to know who the heck was gathering, you know, grabbing their files. But there, you would just have a file, you know, hierarchy, and you could grab whatever files you wanted. And there could be very nice, you know, if you're looking for interesting things on the internet, that was how you got it. You download documents to your system and then browse them. The difference with things like Gopher and Waze is you could actually view the documents as you're accessing them. Normally, an FTP client, you would just be seeing a file listing, you'd grab them, and then you'd look at them offline. Here, you would look at them, you'd find a document, oh, it would refer to another document, you could follow the link and go to it. So, who's this Tim Berners-Lee? What did he do that was so special? Why did HTML and HTTP turn out to be such a potent mix?
It sounds similar.
So he was thinking hypertext. He didn't coin the term. Turns out HTML is a very simple format for documents, which is not or completely original either. HTML is based on the older SGML document format. So SGML, Standard Generalized Markup Language, I think is what it stands for. So SGML was this format for storing documents where you would separate content from the presentation. It was originally developed for things like books. So you would be able to specify the entire document type. You'd have a style sheet for that, and then you create the actual document. Now, Tim Berners-Lee saw this SGML, particularly their syntax with the angle brackets and tags and stuff, and said, well, that's really cool, but man, that's complicated. Let me make a simple one. Won't need a separate style sheet to describe what it's like. Instead, I'm just going to have a standard one. And that's what he created HTML based on.
Basically an SGML style sheet.
Well, HTML is essentially a standard, you know, SGML with a default style sheet.
Right.
A really boring one, in fact. So he did that, and then he created, you know, one of the key tags he created in there was the A tag. Ref. So he didn't create the syntax, but he said, okay, well, let's have an A tag and a reference, and this reference would be a URL. Now, URL-like things and stuff actually were kind of around, too.
URL?
URL-like things. I mean, I think the syntax, he proposed a slightly different syntax. But the syntax is really very not very different from other formats. Like when you say Gopher and other things, anonymous FTP, I mean, that was useful but not horribly innovative. There's one key thing about HTML and HTTP that pushed it over the edge. Images. Inline pictures. And text formatting. That was in the first web browser. That was what he was doing. So, anyone know what platform Tim Berners-Lee developed the first web browser on?
Windows ME.
Next. Any of you using the descendant of Next right now?
Lots of people.
My phone's recording on the descendant of Next app.
Yeah.
Next step became macOS, became iOS. Same darn stuff
Darwin.
Underneath.
Darwin.
Well, Darwin's not the most interesting part of it. It's more the object stuff. If you start programming iOS, you'll notice a lot of the core objects start with the letters NS. The NS stands for next step.
So I was reading off history of those long ago. Mm-hmm. Wasn't there some controversy around the image tag? The reason I'm saying it was implemented afterwards is because I thought there was a debate around using either an objects tag or a media tag instead of an image tag.
The first web browsers had images. The thing about images is what format are you going to do it in? And are you going to do it? And originally, they were doing things like GIFs, and then TIFFs, and then JPEGs came along, and then PNGs came along. But then there was also, well, what about video and other things? So that's why the media tag and things, trying to come up with some sort of generalized way of representing multimedia objects and stuff, and putting an audio in and things. And people were thinking about this in the early 90s. So yeah, there's a number of controversies over standards of how to do things, but normally the controversies are not about how do I get this basic function out of it, and how do I standardize it. Tim Berners-Lee implemented the blink tag. You know, there are warts.
The what tag?
Blink. You all do not know the blink tag? Consider yourselves blessed. The blink tag is what makes text go on and off. They used to have the tag all the time. So the point I'm telling you about all this is that HTML, the reason why the World Wide Web succeeded the way it did was it had to do with things like accessibility for programmers and appeal to end users. And just having a small little advantage at the right place at the right time made all the difference. Because Gopher and Waze were all text-based. Could they have been extended with images? Yeah, but again, like, a lot of these were based on text menus. They had no notion of page formatting. I mean, it was really like, okay, I'm going to go through an index, select it. I mean, it was all very functional. It was all very Spartan. And Tim Berners-Lee, well, I'll add formatting. I'll add markup. You know, he had seen this HTML thing and thought, well, what if I put that into the web? And by making that sort of insight, and then adding a little bit, and then doing a simple prototype, getting the code out there, choosing a simple protocol for transferring stuff, HTTP, combining those, just a whole set of little ideas that were other people had pieces of. He was the one who brought the right mix together for sharing documents among physicists. And then people saw it and it took off. And people saw, oh, that's really cool, I'll build one. So, like, what was the first really popular web browser? Anyone remember that? Anyone know that?
Mosaic.
Mosaic, which begat Netscape, which begat Mozilla, which begat Firefox. Direct descendant. So if you're looking at the web and you're looking at the pieces here, you'll see that. So when we say HTTP, this is the file transfer protocol. Could you use another document protocol? Yes. But this is what we standardized on, and this is what's used. And you'll see, I mean, there's things like, okay, the GET, and those standard return codes, and there's a protocol name. And you'll notice that the protocol, even today, isn't that complicated. It's added certain extensions to it, but it's still very simple. And mostly what you're doing is GETs. Basically, GETs, puts posts, GET and POST. Is what you must do. Get for getting a regular page, post for posting a form. That's mostly what you do on the internet. And every time you make a request, your browser sends out the URL and sends out some other headers. Now, one thing I wanted to show you as part of this, I mean, the number of things, so this was, I'll just, so when you say these, I was actually going to Ars Technica, which is kind of a nice modern page, and just, Look at that bar go. Did you see all that? Because, see, every element of the page is a separate URL. All those images, each are a separate URL. They all have to be grabbed. Now, in the originally, having so many separate files to retrieve would be a problem, would slow down page load. Nowadays, page load time is more proportional to the amount of, you know, bytes transferred. And that's because in a given connection, you can request multiple objects, make multiple HTTP requests. So note the complexity here. The original design of HTTP and HTML was that you would have a web server which would send files. You'd have a set of files, you'd request the file that you wanted, and then you'd have the web client, the web browser, which would render it. Which is more complicated, the browser or the server? The browser, by a lot. The server doesn't do anything with trying to figure out how the page is supposed to look or negotiating. It's just serving files. That's all it's doing. And then it dumps it to the browser, and the browser does all the heavy lifting. That's also a key part of the success of the web. It had very simple servers. Other systems, the server would, you know, render the entire interface and send it down to the client. That limits scalability, because what happens when you have 10,000 people trying to access your website? If it's a simple server, you can scale up much more easily.
It depends how you design it. If you're cloning a process every time, you might not scale up.
We're going to get that in a second. So, but there's this fundamentally more computation going on. So one thing that's not shown here, which I wanted to show you, and I can't, which I don't have a good look. Can I see more of this? Yes, I can. Oh, wonderful. Okay, so this is showing when you make so requested URL. Okay, there's the URL method request status code, requested headers sent cookie. So you want to know cookies? We've got cookies. So what this means is, so a cookie in computer parlance is something that is sent one direction and then always comes back. It's like, if I want to give you a cookie, means here's this token, you take it, and then when I ask for it, you give it back to me. And you don't do anything with it. You don't do any computation. The notion of a cookie is you don't do no computation with it. You're just holding it. Which is kind of bizarre, because if you think you get a cookie, you'd want to eat it. But you don't. Cookies are just tokens that you get from the server and you hold on to them when they're asked. And so in the context of the web, websites set cookies in your browser. They set state in your browser, and then they ask for them back. Well, they don't explicitly ask for them back. When you visit a website, when you make an HTTP GET request, any cookies that match are sent. So normally cookies are associated with a domain. So when you send further requests to that domain, you send along the cookies automatically. So you see here, here's a cookie that's being sent. Yeah, this is the cookie.
So that's default browser behavior?
That's default browser behavior. So that's BKs. So this is when we say people, when we talk about tracking on the web and people talk about cookies, cookies are a nice tracking mechanism because they add state to stateless HTTP. Now, notice I said HTTP, you do a GET request. There's a few other things. There's a GET, there's POST. You can ask for just the headers and stuff, but you just send a GET and you give the URL. And the what you get back in response to that GET request is just determined by the contents of that GET request. There's no reliance on any other server state. That's what I mean by stateless. You make a GET request with the same parameters, you should always get back the same answer. Now, of course, in modern web applications, the dynamic content, but the original model is you send this request, you get back the same result. Cookies change that because that state that's added to the client, it changes the request. The first time you request it, you had no cookie. Okay, so it sets a cookie. Now, next time you make the request the same URL, you'll get a different response back because you've got a cookie that you're going to send it. You've changed the GET request, but you haven't changed the URL. You've changed the headers that go along with it. The URL will be the same, cookies will be different. So let me see if I can kind of get back up to the top here. Okay, so... okay. So again, you'll notice cookies are everywhere. Because modern websites want to keep track of you in some ways. They need to do it for ad tracking or whenever you're logged in or something. Cookies are the standard way of doing it. They aren't the only way of doing it. What's the other place you can make the HTTP request stateful? You can change the URL. Right? And it turns out in HTML5, there's other ways of keeping storage in the client side. But basically, you make a request, your browser makes a request, it will send some state to the server. And the state it sends is more than the actual URL. In fact, there's in general ways of... well, I don't think it shows these things, but does it show all the headers? No, it doesn't. This one doesn't show all the headers. There's a nice extension called HTTP Live Headers for Firefox. I wanted to run it here, but this is a too old of an installation of Firefox. It's all messed up. But when you run HTTP Live Headers, it will show you exactly what is happening with each GET request. It shows you all of the headers. And you look at how much information is being sent from your browser for each request, it's rather substantial. It's in fact... what?
Is Chrome installed?
What's that baked in with Chrome?
You just need to search for it. Yeah, it's probably in your user directory.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, there it is. Now the question is, I'm kind of curious what version they have here. Okay, let's see now. So you're saying web developer, the control shift A?
Or
above
control shift. Okay, so it looks like it's showing kind of like what the other. So here you're getting
the.
Okay, no, that's not what I want. Headers? Ah, headers. Got it. Beautiful. Okay, yeah, this is... there we go. Thank you. So, you see the URLs here, the request method, the return code, but then you see all the headers that come with it. We'll accept anything. We'll accept these character sets, this is the encoding, the language, the host, the refer, who sent us to this page, the user agent string. What browser am I using? Oh, this is... Mozilla 5.0. Why is it saying Mozilla 5.0? Because, well, browsers nowadays just say that. But this is on Windows NT 6.1, no, Apple WebKit, KHTML, like, oh, what does it say? Did it say like Gecko?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that was the one that... So Gecko is a rendering engine for Firefox. So it's every time you make a request, it's telling the web server that it's this renderer is like Firefox's. So give me something similar. And then the response header. So this is what it sent back: the age, cache control. This is how long can you remember this? How long is it? What type is it? The date. The protocol is very simple, but extensible. That's the nice thing about HTTP. That's one reason why it's stuck around. You have all this other state in these headers that get sent back and forth. And then to get that, you get. What was it? You get all this sort of stuff. Yes?
Aside from headers, cookies, bodies, what else is there to the HTTP protocol?
So if you look up the actual commands for HTTP, it's like six. What? Hypertext Transfer Protocol. these, okay, so the technical, so here they are. Get, head, post, put, delete, trace, options, connect, patch.
So it's a bunch of headers and conventions.
Yeah, so it's super small. I mean, this is it. And basically, the only parts of this that you really use is get and post. Really. And, but what it makes it different is that there are these headers associated with it. You don't just ask for the URL, you ask for these headers. You give these headers and it comes back. In those headers can be arbitrary content. And a bunch of conventions have evolved around it. But when you talk about things like cookies, when you talk about HTML, the HTML5 spec and having, you know, client-side storage and other things, they're all building on this foundation. It's all in there. Now let's step down a level, which is part of what I want to address with what makes a, you know, what things are easy as a web app and what things are hard as a web app. So the thing to understand first is what is HTTP transmitted over? So, HTTP is over HTTP goes over TCP. Now, I don't want to give a full overview of networking right now, although we're going to have hopefully an overview of it later in the class. But the internet is built on this, TCP/IP. TCP stands for the Transmission Control Protocol. IP stands for the Internet Protocol. How many of you know about packet switch networks? Oh, that's okay. So,
new lecture.
Well, I want to give a simplified version of this. So before there was the internet, there was the phone system. The idea of the phone system was I want to talk to someone else. So in order to talk to someone else, basically you have to form an electrical circuit between your phone and someone else's phone. And so in the old phone system, they would literally use plug boards to connect your phone with another one. And there was only so many interconnection switches. So if everyone tried making a phone call at the same time, the system would never be able to handle it. It could only handle something like 10% or something of all phones talking to each other. But basically, the entire phone network was just interconnections for these wires. So you would have a circuit between your phone and another phone. And that's what allowed voice to transfer between the two. Now, those smart folks at Bell Labs realized this was inefficient. We can do better. And instead of having an entire circuit, entire reserve circuit for just transmitting one person's phone call, they could stick more information on that wire. They wanted to multiplex multiple calls over the same circuit. So how do you do that?
Frame relay.
Well, the basic idea.
Shrink it down and then stick 24 of them in a row and then thing the other end to read.
Well, you chunk it to time splicing, so you basically transmit however many every one gets a fraction of whatever your set interval is.
So you've all had chats with multiple people at the same time, right? Messaging, IM, text messaging, Facebook, whatever. You talk with, three, four, five people and have concurrent conversations with them at the same time. And what you do is you talk with one, you send some information there, you wait for their turn, then you go to the next one and you send some information, wait their turn, and you just sort of switch between them. That's essentially what's happening every time you make a voice call. With the circuit. You're not getting the whole circuit's attention at any time. It's just that to send 1 second of conversation, it requires maybe a millisecond. So that's why you can fit multiple conversations there. It's like each time it gets sent along, you're actually sharing that network with other people talking. Now, the idea of this is known as packet-switched networks. Yes. Yes. It's
that's
all
one more leaf.
What? Huh?
Well, multiplexing is not.
Yeah. Yes, but the switching, but it's all about packets.
Yeah.
And that's why packets are worth doing, is because of the routing. If you don't do the routing, the packets make no sense.
Multiplexing is packets without routing. The basic one.
No, but there's implicit routing because you have the multiplex. Where it's all coming from.
If you have a direct end-to-end connection that you want to carry. Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
So what is a packet? A packet is just a fixed-size document, fixed-size unit of information. Typically on the internet, we're talking about around, we're talking, 150 to, 1,500 bytes. It can be smaller, it can be bigger, but you're talking packets of about 1K. So everything that's sent on the internet is sent in these packets, and each of these packets are labeled with a source and destination. One way of thinking of them is postcards, because certainly they are open to be read by anyone who touches them. When you talk on the internet, you're sending a bunch of these requests out in the form of packets, and you get more packets back. Now, if you think about this for a second, wait a second. I probably want a continuous stream of communication. I'm getting packets. Is that good? Well, I left out one little part.
The nukes?
Mm-hmm. That's what the nukes, but the packets don't always make it to their destination. The internet is based on an idea called best effort. Which means it will try to get the information there. With a circuit switch network, you get a reservation. You get a guarantee. Either if you get a phone call through, you actually connect to the other side, you have the resources for talking. And there should be no degradation in voice quality because you have resources reserved for it. In the packet switched in the network with best effort, you can get some information through, and then some of it might drop, some of it might, things you get can get gaps in your conversation. Because maybe some router somewhere got overwhelmed. Maybe there was some electrical interference. Who knows? Maybe a tree fell and broke a line. But there's.
Maybe it just didn't feel like it.
Maybe it just didn't feel like it, yes. Maybe there's a software bug. But anyway, packets are getting dropped all over the place at multiple places. So if you're building a program that depends on communication of something that's this unreliable, you should go, crap. Because building any sort of thing on top of this, if you have to deal with it constantly being unreliable, not fun. So that's what the network engineers, the best way to build the internet was to make it unreliable. That was the way to make it scalable. But that means that on top of it, you need a mechanism to make it reliable. And so IP, this is IP, is the packets. TCP is the transmission control protocol. That's what turns the packets into a stream of bytes for communicating two-way on the internet. TCP takes care of reordering packets as necessary if they arrive in the wrong order, and requesting retransmissions if packets get dropped. HTTP is a protocol based on TCP. So you go, okay, it's reliable, great. No. What TCP does is it tries to provide a reliable network infrastructure, a communication channel. But what happens when a packet gets dropped? It has to ask for a retransmission.
how does this manifest at the level of HTTP?
The loading thing?
The loading thing. Your connection pauses because you're waiting for the data to come through. Oh, and it's worse than that. Because an assumption of TCP is that when packets are dropped, the network is congested. And TCP is designed to be polite. So, for example, if you saw a giant throng of people trying to get through the doors into this room, what do you do? Do you pile into that throng and try to shove yourself through the door? Or do you maybe go away for a little while?
Look
for another door. Well, let's assume that's the only door.
Register for another class.
Oh, register for another class, okay. Well, if you really have to go through, you're going to go away and come back later. If you have to go through that door, you're going to go away and come back, unless you're just overly persistent. But that's really considered being rude. If you're going to be polite, you'll walk away, let the crowd disperse, and then come back. Now, first you might think, well, it'll disperse in a few seconds. So I'll come back in a few seconds. You come back. Oh, it's still there. Okay, maybe I'll wait a minute. Okay. Oh, still not there. Maybe I'll come back in 5 minutes. Oh, maybe I should come back in half an hour. That's what TCP does. It does exponential back off. Yes? Sorry? Polite's not the actual terminology is exponential back off. But politeness is, that's certainly a term I've heard used to describe this sort of behavior. Because it is possible to make an internet client that doesn't respect these sort of patterns, and they're considered to be rude. But, or bandwidth hogs, just various kinds of derogatory things. But TCP is designed to get along well with other instances of TCP and other ones that obey this, that say, they all say, oh, there's congestion. I'll back off. I'll lower my transmission rate. And I'll lower it exponentially. But the trouble is, it isn't just congestion that causes this. What's something else that can cause packets to be dropped? How about me turning on my microwave? Wireless interference. Wireless is horrible for this, because for a little while the communication channel, wireless medium, is congested, and then all of a sudden it goes away because the interference goes away. TCP is not designed to recognize this. It assumes it's going to be a long phenomenon. Now there's been various tweaks to TCP to try to make it better for this and stuff, but this is the key to why web programming is much, much trickier than doing things on a desktop. You can't just think of web programming as a separation between client and server, and you have a protocol there. You have to think of this as a separation between client and server over this unreliable, highly variable communications medium. So there's a characteristics for what I'm saying that varies. Do I know what it is? Latency. This is the word that you should associate with doing web applications. Everything else is fixable with just throwing more resources. You say, oh, I want to go to this, I want to have a better web app, I can just have bigger pipes. Buy more fiber optics. Buy a better router. Pay my, pay Bell or Rogers or whatever more money.
Tech Savvy.
Well, you're still paying Bell or Rogers. Just indirectly.
If you're Goldman Sachs, you can, buy a building closer to the exchange and reduce
it. Yes, the other way. But you're dealing with the laws of physics.
Yes.
But this is the key thing for designing the web is you have to deal with latency. So what do I mean by latency? I mean it's the time to get the first byte. Now I'm contrasting this with, so this is not bandwidth. Ideally you want low latency and high bandwidth. So I'll give an example of a high bandwidth, high latency connection. a rescue dog carrying a bunch of optical discs. So you know, let's say carrying like 50 Blu-ray discs. Rescue dog running across things, or even better, a semi-truck full of hard drives.
I think some senator actually made that analogy once. Mm-hmm. The internet's like a truck or something.
Oh, those tubes.
No, there's that.
I can believe that. But so you want to move insane amounts of data. You want to move petabytes across Canada. What's the best way to do it? You just want to maximize bandwidth? The best way may be just to load up a truck with your hard drives and truck it across. Now, the latency of that connection is going to be very high. What that means is the time required to get one byte out of the connection is like a week. But once you get the first byte, you've got petabytes. And that's, to a first approximation, is what the internet looks like to your application. You can get lots of data from the remote server. The client can send lots of data to this, to the server. We have relatively high bandwidth connections nowadays on the internet. But the latency is still rather high. So much of the magic of web programming is, what do you do to hide the latency? So, to give you an idea of the sophistication of this, so how many of you use Gmail? Yeah. So Gmail is generally considered to be one of the first really good, web-based email clients. It's still arguably, in many ways you consider it the best, although if you look at your competitors, they are also very good. But one thing you'll notice when using Gmail is that, you want to scroll through email, you want to look at things, it's very responsive. You'll see your email when you want it. But in the background, it's more than caching. Gmail profiles you and attempts to predict how you're going to read your email next, and loads that email in the background for you. It prefetches it. It thinks, you're probably going to read this email and this email and this email next. So it grabs them in the background and has it there so that when you request it, it'll be there. Because if it requests it just when you click on it, it will hesitate. Because even if your connection is really good, there's still the fundamental latency of it going to ask Google for that email message and the response coming back. It's just fundamental to the way the internet works. So they say, well, if I do this in the background, I can get 100 emails in the background while they're busy reading one. They'll be all downloaded, and so when they request it, it'll all be there. But now if you try doing something that the interface doesn't predict you're going to do, you're going to see it hesitate. Now, you all notice that sometimes it slows down. When you start doing really weird things, it hesitates. But other times, it's smooth as butter. Depends on how good Google is at predicting you. This is what Google's entire business model is in some sense based on, is predicting you, modeling you. Because the better they can model you, the better they can make you happy, and the better they can sell you things.
Well, the more money they can make off you, too.
Yeah, well, that's when they sell things.
It sounds really evil, but it's not.
Depends on your perspective. You are not Google's customer. You are Google's product. Google's customers are their advertisers. So this is so. Let's just check. I just want to check to see where am I in terms of
questions.
Yeah. Which ones have I answered?
Like
which ones have I not?
No. I think you got the first one.
One, three, four, and five.
Yeah.
So you're about halfway there.
Okay. Let's. Okay. So what's the biggest constraint of performance of web applications?
Latency.
What's this? Okay, now that I've talked, two I have to talk about. What, three?
Get.
Are cookies sent only when explicitly requested?
No,
they're sent all the time. Because cookies are set on a basis of a domain. You make a request, the cookie comes. There we go. You make a request, the cookie is automatically sent if it matches. So you set, they set a cookie for arstechnica.com. Any subdomain associated with arstechnica, will, those URLs, you'll send along the right cookie. Cookies are normally parsed by client-side JavaScript.
Yes.
False. The whole point of a cookie is it's not parsed on site. It's just stored and sent back. Okay, let me talk about 8 here. So we're talking about latency. The request. So what does Gmail do? It predicts you. How does it predict you? It runs code in the client, in your browser. When we talk about AJAX, asynchronous JavaScript and XML, the key part is the asynchronous JavaScript. It's JavaScript running in the background. And that JavaScript can do not anything, but can do lots of things. And one of the things it can do is talk to its originating server. It can request things from it. It can do computations locally, observe the user, and then say, oh, give me this, give me this, give me this. So what if you instead had the web client, you know, every time you make a request, those requests just get sent to the server? That puts more of a load in the server. So this I would call true, because it potentially increases the performance of the web by offloading computation to clients. Although, depending on how it is, AJAX can also put more of a load on your server because of the caching overload. So
the key thing
is the potential.
Give me all the datas.
Exactly. But of course, then, if you do that, then you're consuming too much bandwidth, and users don't necessarily like it when you consume too much bandwidth. If you start using too much memory in the browser, I mean, this is one reason why browsers often consume ridiculous amounts of memory. It's because they're caching things. I think Chrome still does this. When you visit a search page for Google, it will go ahead and load the top hits. It won't just, it'll say, oh, you're probably going to click on one of the first 10 pages, so we'll go ahead and load them for you.
Oh, okay. It's one of the reasons Google had such good statistics for browser market share.
Right.
Like, there was so many people visiting these.
Because Chrome kept visiting them for them. Basically, you basically look like you're 10 people surfing at the same time. So, but it makes Chrome feel really fast, but it also increases your bandwidth usage. So now we get into client-side programming. JavaScript was not the first choice for client-side programming. Java was. Java applets was really the first choice. And then more recently, you all are using Flash, Flash in websites. So what's the key difference between Java in a browser and JavaScript in the browser?
But
it's a plugin. Flash and Java applets are plugins for the browser. So what do I mean by a plugin?
Once you provide their technology, they want to stand the difference between the browser. So one is a company.
Well,
and
so,
then you have to install.
So there's nothing in principle that makes plugins proprietary. A lot of plugins are proprietary, but that's not...
Well, in this case.
So a plugin is a way to extend browser functionality. Now, there are, in general, browser extensions. Like, I just installed, I tried installing this browser extension, HTTP live headers, which, it's version dependent. Now, whenever you do a browser extension, you're using an extension language specific to that browser. So Chrome has its own way of being extended, Firefox has its own way extended, Internet Explorer has its own way of being extended. You're basically adding code to it. And when you add code to it, the restrictions that are placed, it depends on whatever API the browser places, but in general, the extension can do almost anything. The extension can do almost anything, but they're browser-specific. Chrome extensions can't quite do anything. They actually thought about security. There's some restrictions, but still, Chrome extensions can do an awful lot. But they're specific to Chrome. browser plugins are extensions that are cross-browser. There are standards for browser plugins. That's why multiple browsers can automatically use the same plugins. So when you use Flash, when you use Java applets, Shockwave, Silverlight, PDF readers like Acrobat, puts in a plugin. Those are all, they are using a standard interface, this plugin interface. And the standard is the NP API. This is the Netscape plugin API. So originally Netscape came up with it, other browsers implement it. Now, this is not for general extensions to a browser. Their plugins are very restricted. What a plugin basically says, here's your area of the page. You get this boundary. Give me something to show there. Any events that happen there, I'll give them to you. Here you go. Here's your box. Do your thing.
Have fun.
Yes?
Even though there's NP API, there's commonly plugins. Like, is it always that a plugin will be just the same regardless of what browser you use?
If it's an NP API compatible plugin, then it will work across browsers. Now, Internet Explorer does not support NP API.
Okay.
Everyone else does. So, it's like, that's why Opera can use all the same plugins. Even though it's a minority share one.
So, would it be correct in saying that a plugin is a separate runtime, whereas, like...
So, it can do whatever it wants.
In and of itself.
In general, it's some sort of parser, some sort of runtime for some language.
Right.
So, Silverlight for, the Microsoft Silverlight for understanding, Silverlight, this .NET, C# derivative thingamabob, but you've got Flash. What's the language of Flash?
ActionScript.
What's ActionScript?
JavaScript.
Yeah,
not really.
Yeah, it is.
It's
ECMAScript.
It was based on a tentative ECMAScript specification. But if you've ever used ActionScript, it's not very JavaScript.
It's not DOM.
It's more like Java.
They changed the syntax? I thought it was ECMAScript.
ActionScript 3 is very Java-like. Yeah, it's got classes, it's got
types
that you specify with every variable.
That's why it
does.
Anyway, there are these. So you have a plugin. It's restricted in what it can do on the screen. But where does it run?
On the operating
system. So interesting thing about plugins. It's all you heard about the current uproar over Java. Right now, it looks like Java. If you've been paying attention to what's happening with Java, you should have turned it off in your browser a long time ago. But it's even worse because it looks like there's all these 0 days that have come out now, and all this nasty malware that's been using it. And it's looking like it's going to take. There's so many of these Oracle's probably going to take a couple of years to patch all these things. That's what's known now. So it's just people are just kind of going like, just disable it now. But when you talk about plugins, originally plugins would run inside the same process as the browser, which means that while it was supposed to be restricted on the screen, if it decided to be nasty, it could change the browser in arbitrary ways, i.e. it could do anything that the browser decided to do. It could access all of your files, reformat your hard drive. Your browser shouldn't have the permissions to reformat your hard drive, but it could delete all your files, make arbitrary network connections. Yes?
When Java runs, don't you have to say run this applet or don't run it? Is that not a thing anymore?
Yeah, but once you said yes.
Well, don't say yes.
No, but we're not talking about Java. We're talking about plugins.
Oh.
And we're talking about PDF. Yeah. Which plugins are security risks? Flash?
Anything Adobe, really.
Yeah. Actually, that's true. Adobe does write most of the big ones.
Yes.
No, Oracle. So Oracle's
Java.
Oracle's Java, PDF, Flash. All these plugins have been shown to have lots of security holes. Now, the reason why the attacker is going after the plugins is because the browsers have actually been locked down pretty well. There's been a lot of work on improving browser security. Plugins turn out to be this major hole. Now, modern browsers try to minimize this. Instead of incorporating the plugin into their main process, they try to run it as a separate process. How much of you did you all learn about processes in 2401?
Forking.
Okay, when I talk about security more, I will talk about this. Okay, so one of the plans for this course is that it's between 2401 and 2406, we want to teach the modern computational stack, trying to teach how things work, and this course has got a lot of stuff in it for describing how things work. So, yes? So, that's what I was about to talk about, is that Pepper, so the NPAPI NPAPI standard was designed for plugins that would be incorporated into the main process of the browser, which means it would be in the same address space, which means that it could do anything that the main browser could do in principle if it decided to misbehave. Modern browsers now try to run NPAPI stuff outside of the browser in a separate process and have communication channels, but still, it's not necessarily as locked down as you'd want. More lockdown than it was. The Pepper API is a new browser plugin API that Google has proposed, and only Chrome implements. But it's the idea there is it allows for further isolation of plugins. But what's happening with the web now is plugins are going away. Plugins, as a part of web technology, is basically just it's mostly gone. Not completely gone, but
from a user's point of view, they suck.
Well, who can we really attribute for really saving us from plugins?
Jobs.
Steve Jobs.
Really?
And Apple, because Apple came up with this very popular platform, iOS, and which it gave full web access, but they did not support plugins. And people were all going, what? How can you have a full web experience if you don't have Flash? And you know, you can. I mean, the web standards have had to be improved because there are certain things that some of these plugins can do that standard web technologies couldn't. But what's happened now, instead of having a plugin to get that particular piece of technology, we instead have extended the web browser, given it more functionality. Now, there is a security issue of, okay, now the browser can do even more crazy stuff, but at least now it's being done by a team that's updating their software regularly and trying to care about, and actually caring about security. The record of all the plugin makers is horrible. They keep providing code and, you know, they put it out there and then they forget about it. They don't update it for years. Well, they update it only in response to big things, and then they don't really engineer it further. I mean, it's gotten to the point where Microsoft on Windows 8 only partially supports plugins. You know what I'm talking about? So if you run Internet Explorer, the desktop version of Internet Explorer in Windows 8, it supports all plugins. But if you run the Metro version, the modern interface version of Internet Explorer, it does not support any it supports no plugins. So you'll do these things of trying to watch Netflix in the Internet Explorer, in the Metro version of Internet Explorer, and it will tell you, oh, you need to run the desktop version.
Makes a lot of people really happy.
Oh, it makes a lot of people happy. But you.
Oh, yes. The reason for browsers still compete, and so they have to stay on their toes, whereas with the plugin, Adobe had no competition really for the longest time, and so you have no incentive to...
That's a good point. Most plugins are single vendor. There's only one implementation of Flash that, you know, really is popular is one implementation of PDF, one implementation of Java, and thus complacency and thus security problems. But basically, plugins are on the way out for the, you know, for browsers. Instead, what we're having is these. But if you're looking at security risks, which is more of a risk, a plugin or extension? No, an extension is more of a risk. Because now there's all, and particularly in modern browsers, plugins are isolated. Extensions arbitrarily extend the browser. Yes?
I've never heard of an exploit in an extension. They can't really be exploited by pages sent over the internet.
Yes, they can. Extensions are depth. So there's two things you should think about when security. You think about what is your potential exposure in terms of what could attacker do in principle, and what's your actual exposure in terms of what attackers are actually doing. Plugins are safer in principle than extensions because they add less, because they are restricted in their functionality. But plugins are also very widespread, and so, you know, they are getting more exploited. Now, to give you the worst example you could say of extensions is ActiveX.
Oh my God.
ActiveX was fundamentally a browser extension technology. And ActiveX was basically a way to download Windows code and just install it on your system. And all the only protection you had was it was signed. ActiveX was a bad idea when it was first proposed. Everyone knew it was a bad idea. It still got out there. And yeah. So that's why I say extensions are more dangerous than plugins. That doesn't say that plugins aren't really dangerous. So, Atara, this, cookies, yeah. Okay, number two. Piece of history I skipped.
Which I will.
So we go back in time to the web, 92, 93. People are putting on web pages. They have this idea of static web pages. The idea is they have a file. The web server takes the file, delivers it to the client. What happened? People realize, wait, I don't always want to return files. Maybe I want to have the server be a bit smarter. I want it to maybe run a program that takes the URL as an input and parses it and then does something interesting with it. CGI. That's what I'm looking for there, CGI. The Common Gateway Interface. The Common Gateway Interface was a standard. So the plugin, the NPAPI, is a standard for clients to run extensions. The CGI interface is a standard for the web servers to run extensions. That's what CGI bin is for. When you see that, it's running a server-side basically a web server extension. You could write things following the CGI standard in C or C++, but originally they were written mostly in things like Perl. Now CGI, what I want to end on is that CGI had a very interesting problem in terms of web performance, which is that in response to every request, you would start up an entire program to service the request. You would start up a Perl instance to service the incoming URL request. This is kind of heavyweight. There are various standards for having persistent CGI programs that would run in the background, but this was the original model of CGI, that the program would start up, and it would have to be a very quick, light program because it would have to happen in response to each URL. But mostly what you wanted these CGI things to do was to access state, to run a program that used some back-end data store, parsed it, and then returned part of it. So a CGI script could just look for a file, but if it's just reading a file, then the web server could have just done that. What it probably wants to do is take some bits of information, maybe from multiple files, and link them together. This is where databases come in. This is why databases became so central to early web servers, was because you wanted to maintain state. You wanted to have a way of having a data store that could be accessed very quickly by the CGI scripts. You wanted to do something more sophisticated than just read in a file. If you want to read in a file, it would have been a big file, and if you loaded the big file every time the script was called, you'd be in bad shape. So instead, you have some program that has access to lots of data, and then will return it quickly. And the CGI script will then, you know, access that and then do things. So that's where the databases come in, is to provide persistent access. And that's why it became separate, as opposed to being part of the web server. The web server was supposed to be this really simple thing that just served files. It had extensions for running programs. Those programs had to be very lightweight, and so the data handling had to be done by another program, the database. And I think I'm just about out of time. Any last questions? Yes?
You said that the Tapper is being proposed right now by...
No, it's implemented by Chrome. But no one else implements it. The only extension I've heard of implementing, of doing Pepper, is newer versions of Flash are supposed to support Pepper, and so it's not clear what Firefox is going to do about that, but Firefox apparently has no plans right now for implementing it. It's a proposed standard.
Is that true?
Thank you.
Is it true or false?
So one second.